Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast, conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. Thanks for all your support. Appreciate all those rates and reviews on Apple Podcasts and the other platforms. The feedback you've been sending me on social media and email has been wonderful, just invaluable. Thank you. Be sure to turn on notifications so you always know when there's a new episode. I'll be posting new episodes on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings. And check out my new YouTube page so you can see some of these conversations instead of just listening to the podcasts. Link to it at aaronbender.com. Before we get to my conversation with true crime YouTubers Stephanie Harlow and John Crimes, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of two girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job, then lost it. A year and a half ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I could learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, self-care, patience, and understanding. Stephanie Harlow has been creating content on YouTube for 3 years. In fact, happy anniversary, Stephanie. Posted your first video on April 12th, 2018. Lots of beauty reviews and unboxings, but in July of that year, she started experimenting with Mystery Mondays, posting true crime content, and as you'll hear Stephanie tell the story, true crime quickly took over. Also that year, 2018, John Crimes moved into the true crime space on YouTube, and he's quickly gained a loyal following. I asked Stephanie and John how they knew each other, and he said, you know, basically, it's like how I ended up talking with them. He just contacted Stephanie as he tried to get into the true crime space. Stephanie's been into the genre since she can remember.
I've always been interested in true crime, just as a very young child, even more, you know, mysteries and putting puzzles together and things like that. So when I started on YouTube, I wasn't doing true crime. Because when I started on YouTube, I didn't even know what YouTube really had to offer, you know, so I thought they did only makeup and skincare videos. So that's what I started with. And then as I was going through YouTube, once I was a YouTuber, I was like, oh, yo, these people are doing, you know, videos about true crime and their, you know, mysteries and conspiracies and things like that. All these things that really interest me. And I just didn't think that anybody else was really like that, because before you get on the internet, you don't know how many people share your interests. You kind of feel alone. And that's what's great about the internet. But the videos I was seeing were very short, 25 minutes. And I'd always be left wondering, oh, well, what happened here? You know, and what about this little detail? And where did that one suspect go off to? So I thought maybe I'll make videos that give you everything, you know, very detailed, very long, long form sorts of content that, you know, people don't have to have questions when they leave. They know exactly what happened and present it to people in a storytelling fashion that keeps them interested and, you know, in suspense. So that's what I started doing. I made videos that I would want to watch.
What were you doing prior to that, that either allowed you the space to be able to get into that arena, or did you just have to walk away from whatever it was and go full force into YouTube and podcasts?
I kept doing what I was doing before, true, and you know, the makeup and stuff, but I would do like a true crime video once a month. And I said, well, you know, people don't like it. At least they know that's not everything that's there. And if they like it, then that's great. I've made connections, but people really liked it. So then I started obviously focusing my content on that, which is what I really wanted to do anyways. And I was getting a great positive response. So it just sort of shifted gears that way organically. And then that's what it is now.
How long did it take for you to transition out of what you were doing before and then go true crime?
Not long.
Full time.
Not long. Maybe a couple months.
Because it just started. It just resonated with people. You saw the interaction. And it really kind of sounds like it lit a fire in you that the other content just wasn't doing.
Absolutely. Exactly. It did. And I enjoyed doing it and I enjoyed creating the videos. So I just kept doing more of them. And then, you know, with YouTube, once you get into the algorithm, you'll be okay. As long as you continue putting out the same content that the people are subscribing to you for, you'll be fine. Once you hit that algorithm and YouTube starts recommending you.
Family-wise, how did it all fit in? Because there aren't many rabbit holes that go as deep as true crime. You talk about that algorithm, it can trap you, not just for hours, but for days or weeks, where it's like, okay, I want to do nothing else with my free time but true crime. How did it all work out family-wise?
Well, I think anything's a balance, even a normal job. I'm the kind of person that even with my normal job, I would almost throw myself into it too much. So I had already learned by the time YouTube came around how to pace myself and you know when to pull away. But it was a lot of early mornings, a lot of late nights, a lot of, you know, being awake when everyone else was asleep to get it done. And you know, now I think that I think I have a good balance. I can pull away. There are certain cases that it's harder, where I'm sort of stuck and I'm trying to find all this extra time. You know, I'm like sitting in my car for 45 minutes after I've gotten home just so nobody sees me researching, but
we've all been there. Yeah. Either decompress or, you know, there's a storm inside and you're like, I like the calm out here for a few minutes.
Yeah. I'm going to extend the piece.
And what about you, John? I mean, you're into music and film documentary style. What really drew you to this space and this genre?
I've always been interested in true crime. Didn't matter what I was doing. Like, I was on YouTube. At the time, I was writing articles for different hip hop magazines, and I had a YouTube channel catered towards hip hop. And they asked me what I do in my free time, and I would tell them. I even got clips of it. I'm like, you guys would be shocked. I'm into true crime. And my audience was like, wow. And they would say, well, what channels do you recommend? And I would always recommend this YouTuber by the name of Kendall Ray and this other one, Daniel Holland. And I watched them. They were huge and big. But then I started watching newer people do it. And she was one of the newer people. She had a very small channel. And I remember my comments still should be on her channel. I said to her,
be still on your channel, yeah, right?
I said, you're going to blow up. Once I saw her details and how she was doing the videos and in depth they were, I knew instantly. I said, this girl going to blow up. And I watched one of her lives. And when I was watching her live, she said where she was working at the time. And I had the same job. And I'm like, I've always wanted to do true crime. And I always made excuses. But here is somebody who's balancing mom, you know, wife work. She balancing all these pieces together. So I had no more excuses to make. I asked myself, well, what's your excuse now? And then I made my channel.
And what was that process like for you to make that channel? Why YouTube and not just podcasting? And, you know, we mentioned already you're a film guy. So I would imagine you gravitated toward the visual immediately.
Also, I'm a film guy, the visuals. But this will be a shocker to people. I had never in my life heard of the word podcast before.
Prior to when it
just kind of blew up in there. I think I did by Joe Rogan, but I didn't associate Joe Rogan to podcast, even though it's a Joe Rogan podcast. He was just a guy I watched on YouTube. You know,
right?
It was a visual experience for me, so it was always to make the YouTube videos, and I didn't plan to make it more visual. I didn't plan to hire actors and go as in depth as I do on my stuff. It just kind of happened organically. I'll drive in my car, like she said, and I'll think of something. And when I think of it, I'll get so wrapped on the idea. And I'm like, I got to do it. And I'll do it.
You're in the same studio right now. You're in the same space right now, but you're just visiting so that Stephanie can scare you in the morning. Because you're staying.
As she did.
That was great on her Instagram. It was fantastic.
I scare everybody.
Yeah, she got one comment. She don't know it yet, but she got one comment.
I'm stone cold. Like, he's going to jump out of me. I'm going to look at him like nothing happened.
Yeah.
We all have. Yeah. You're like, wait a minute. Just wait until you see what I've got planned. But we all have kids, so we got to be on our toes all at the same time. Family-wise for you, John. How did it all work out in terms of, again, like what Stephanie mentioned, the balance of things?
Mm-hmm. Well, true crime is a different topic, but on filming, making movies, all the stuff I'm doing artistically has always been in my life. And so it was easy to me. You just do, you have to lose sleep. So you have to make a choice. Like if you got a normal job, that's 8 hours. And then after that, you want to be with your children or whatever, your regular life. That's almost 8 hours. So you don't want to lose from that. So you have to lose sleep. So it was like a Bruce Wayne, Batman kind of thing. Everybody would go to bed when I first started. And then I would go down to the basement and then I would turn into John Grimes and do it. You just lose sleep. You can lose something else. But you're going to lose something.
Now, Crimes, is that your real name or did you develop that?
My real name is John Rhines with an N. is a Nancy. So rhymes mixed with crimes, you know, so it's John C-H-R-Y-M-E-S.
Yeah, because we've got somebody here in L.A. who does weather, Dallas Rains. And so, and he claims up and down that's his real name. So, of course, he's destined to do weather. And I'm just wondering if you were always destined to do some sort of true crime.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've always wanted to do it. I didn't even know that it was a thing on YouTube. When I saw Kendall Ray, I was like, I thought it was just her. I'm like, just there's a girl doing it. And I didn't do it at the time because I'm like, I don't want to step on what she got going. I just thought it was her. I didn't know it was like a lot of people that was doing it.
Right. And, like there's no other room for anybody else in the space.
Yeah. I just like, he's just going to leave hip hop and come into the crime field. Because people only know what you put out. If you know me for hip hop, you just think hip hop. You don't know my brain and how in depth and how much I've been interested in this field. And a lot of other people, too. People only get the little glimpse of you online.
Before we get to some specific projects, I want to find out, because we do talk on the podcast a lot about mental health, and with a topic mm-hmm. like true crime, and you deal with families, victims' families, suspects, defendants, killers' families, and the killers themselves, you know, that's a headspace that not everybody can get into, and it's especially not a headspace that people can easily come out of and disconnect from. How do you both maintain that balance? We go back to that word balance.
For me, it's just about compartmentalization. You really, and like I said, I was interested in true crime for a long time. So I kind of had already been doing that because you do get into these cases and obviously you start to see the victims and the people around you, your family members, your mother, your kids, and that can be very jarring. But you do have to, you know, try to separate because I find myself being very paranoid all the time, you know, especially with my kids, like don't go outside. And, you know, if they walk outside to like be in our driveway, I just have to run out after them and watch them the whole time. So I think that's a positive kind of
paranoia.
Yeah, that's a positive paranoia because I have seen things happen. You know, the parents will be like, we turned our back for 30 seconds. So I don't mind that. But you know, you can't be afraid to leave the house. You can't be afraid to go out in the real world. So that is a struggle, but it's all about compartmentalization and just sort of having to remind myself constantly, you know, that there's more to the world. I'm not sitting here every day looking into all the positive things and all the nice things people do. I'm looking into the horrible things that people do to each other. And it can skew your view of the world where you start to look at the world as this very dark place, this very terrible place. And I have to constantly remind myself that it's not. So usually I'll go on TikTok and watch funny videos and laugh and say, oh, look at these people. They're so happy. They're so creative. They're so kind. There's good people in the world. And, you know, and just push past it.
Mm-hmm. It was different for me. And I'm glad I became friends with Stephanie very early on because I started doing my cases and she would watch them. And I remember my second case I've done on Caitlin Nicole Davis. That was really hard for me, man. Like, she gave me advice. Like, I had to step away from YouTube for a moment. It was the first time, like, I went to the city where she lived. And it's just like, I felt her whole life. I felt everything around her. I felt like I was walking in her shoes. I went to the tree that she hung herself on and stood in front of it. And when I put out the video, like, I dropped it on YouTube and everybody's watching it, which is in the first hour. And I was talking to Stephanie behind the scenes and she was like, you probably need to like pull yourself back a little bit because it was just this really, like, I felt all this anxiety in my chest. It was really, really a weird feeling. And I felt like I was turning my back on her, the girl in the case, because it was done. The video was out. I can delete all the folders. I can remove all the information I have on her. It's like she's about to die for me. All over again. So I had to disconnect. And I hate to say this, you know, but it's the truth. You get used to it. The most heartfelt that way felt about these cases at the beginning, like they don't hurt. It still suck. Like when you let them go, or like I just did Jaren Lockhart and I put over a year working on that documentary. And it sucked letting go and going to a new world, but it didn't hurt as much as the beginning cases did.
I think honestly, to me, what's worse for my mental health than these cases, because the cases, at least you feel like you're doing something positive. You know, you're giving a voice to somebody who no longer has one. What's worse for my mental health is social media in general. The comment section on your YouTube videos, usually very good, but you run into that one comment and you poured your whole heart and your soul into this case. And, you know, and then they just find one thing about it and they're like, oh, you're stupid because you think this. And you're like, what the heck? Like, makes it feel like, you know, all your work and they don't appreciate it. But once again, that's perspective. This is one person out of hundreds of thousands of people, but the comment section can get toxic, even in general, just being on social media because you want to interact with people, but you also have to realize that you need time for yourself and your family. So I could be working 24/7 because people are tweeting at me, cases they want me to cover, even personal family members that they want me to look into. And you almost feel like, oh, I need to be there on Twitter and Instagram. So I'm getting these people and they feel heard and they know I'm there. But at the same time, like, you're just constantly steeped in it. And there's a big responsibility because you feel like people want things from you and you could never do every case that everyone wants or look into everybody's family member. So you start to feel guilty and you start to feel the pressure and, you know, the weight of the world. So you just, especially Twitter for me, I've had to completely stop. Like, I go on maybe a couple times a week to share my videos or just to scroll through, but I try not to stay there. I'm a visitor. I don't live there.
Aaron, have you ever seen or felt at one time in your life, like, you see a celebrity and, I don't know, I had this experience before. I'm almost next to get my autograph from the celebrity, and then they get up, they close shop.
Yes.
I don't know. They could have been there for 3 hours. I don't know. All I know is I feel hurt, you know? So you be shocked at your inbox. You get these extremely detailed, really long stories that, you know, these people are crying to send you. And so when you first start off, you're like, I'm not going to be like the other person. I'm going to answer everybody. Everybody sends me a message. I'm going to do it. And you got your heart into it, but it's going to get to that point to where you just physically can't. It's impossible. And now you are that person that you say that you know, because you can't help it. You know, you can't, you don't, it's the only one person. So that part kind of sucks.
Did you get advice from law enforcement officers or other people in law enforcement or therapists on how to kind of keep things at an arm's length and not make it too personal?
Kind of now, not at the beginning. You just go in making videos. Now I have a friend who I met through this, who's a psychologist, and they deal with patients all the time. And I talk to them. And then now Stephanie has a podcast host that is a detective. So I don't think we started off with that advice.
No, I think if you see somebody who's doing true crime regularly, most likely they never did get help. It just became something that they grew accustomed to doing. Like, they figured it out on their own, and it's different for everyone, right? So what's going to relax me or give me balance or help me worry about my mental health is different than the next person. So I do think that's a process and a process that you have to go through to figure out what works for you. Is it going for a run? Is it exercising? Is it watching something stupid on TV? Is it getting high at the end of the night and then forgetting, you know, so you can shut your brain off?
Right.
Is it having a glass of wine? Is it, you know, talking to a friend? Is it all of those things depending on the day? It's just really based on the day, but I can always tell when I need that. You know, I get a little cranky, I get a little on edge, and I'm like, all right, you need to pull back and you need to just do something that's going to take your mind off of it.
What are some things that you do for self-care?
For me, working out is something that's good because I find that drives everything away. Just a good meal, a glass of wine, hanging out with your family, like just playing with my kids. You know, you can't feel that the world is a bad place or that things are just too heavy when you're playing with your kids. They are so happy and they just get super pumped about everything. So are we playing charades? Are we playing hide and seek? Am I just standing out there in the fresh air, watching them ride their bikes? Getting outside is good, especially now for quarantine. We've all been locked inside for so long. And there would be days at the beginning where I would be like, what's the point if you even walking outside? You know, what am I going to do once I walk outside? I can't go anywhere. But now just walking outside, looking at the sky, you know, listening to like the wind blowing through the trees, just these little things that you don't pay attention to. Just listening to it, you feel grounded. You realize your feet are on the ground and you're in a, you know, even though it's a rock spinning in space and we don't know what the hell is going to happen tomorrow. Right now it's good.
Yeah. I would say mine is music. And I saw you went to my Instagram.
Yeah.
And tell you something that's funny. If you hear a song There's no depth to it. There's no deep psychological meaning. It's just a booty shake dancing song that is on purpose. Because what more opposite can you get from true crime than that? Like, I'm sitting down to have fun. I don't want nothing serious. And people will hear a 3-minute song and they don't know, like, I'm looking at every sequence to turn this down, turn this up. All the detailed stuff that goes into it is occupying my brain from thinking about the person who was just murdered. I just spent 3 months trying to make a documentary on. So that's me. I do that all the time. That's why you see it on my Instagram.
How do you pick your cases? You talked about all the different pitches you get on social media, in the comment section, in emails. I'm sure you probably get just random letters from people. How do you pick your cases?
We were just talking about that the other day, weren't we?
Yeah.
I mean, for me, and we were just talking about that the other day, I said, I will, you know, get all these recommendations and I'm like, okay, I'm on it and I'll look into it. And obviously every case is important. Every person is important. But if you're going to spend so much time with the case and you're going to want to deliver it in a genuine way that shows you actually care, it has to stick to you. So you could have a playlist of songs that you listen to and you love. It's your playlist. You created this playlist, but you're listening to it and you're like, oh, I don't want to hear that song. No, I don't want to hear that song. You're skipping through it. It doesn't mean you don't like the song. It just means at this point in your life today, it's not sticking to you. You're looking for something else. So I'll grab my case, you know, recommendations. I'll pick one. I'll start looking into it. Sometimes I'm looking into it for like 25, 35 minutes before I'm like, yeah, this isn't working for me right now. Like this isn't, it has to, I don't know if it's maybe something's going on in my life that makes me gravitate towards one case over the other. But once I find that case, it sticks to me. I'm personally like invested and interested to where I can't wait to learn more. And I'm like, okay, I gotta look this up. I gotta look this up. That's when you know it's right. It's kind of like falling in love a little bit. Like you can feel that it clicks.
Yeah.
But then another case that you said, oh, this isn't for me. Maybe 2 weeks, 2 months from now, you go over it again and it sticks to you. Then it's just about timing for me. What is relating to me in this case? I really have to feel that I can relate to something about this victim and what they went through in their life for me to deliver it in a way that's going to make people feel for this person as a three-dimensional real person, not just a character that they're watching on TV or in a movie. Because I think that is the disconnect sometimes when people listen to these cases. It's like, this is a story that I'm listening to for entertainment purposes. And obviously I want it to be entertaining because I want you to hear everything. But at the same time, like, I want you to also feel this person could have been your sister, your brother, your father, your daughter. I want you to feel the pain, not necessarily like I want to hurt people, but I want you to feel that loss because this is a person that's gone. So it really has to just be that to me so that I can make it that for others, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And we so much alike. The only thing I will add to that is probably more in depth like scenario. A lot of people now are asking me to cover JonBenet Ramsey, and we all know her face and the cute little girl who did the pageants. And I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. It's popular. I'm saying yeah because other people want me to do it. And while I'm planning to do it, I'll get a random case pop up and I'll just go look into it and I'm getting pissed. I'm getting angry. I hate what they did to this kid and all this stuff. And this is where my heart is drawing me to. And so I'm not going to do JonBenet Ramsey now. I want to go with this because this is what's pulling me. And that's what you're going to get the best stuff when something is organically pulling you towards that direction. One of my most popular cases is the one I spoke about earlier, Caitlin Nicole Davis. She wasn't murdered. We do true crime. It was suicide. But to see that she did it on social media and kids were picking on her, telling her while she was setting the rope up in the tree to hang herself, there was no way I could turn back. I'm like, I got to do this. You know, it wasn't even my genre. So I just, if you follow your heart, there's no way you can fake that. It's going to come across way more authentic and it's something that you want to do. We all have like 9-to-5 jobs, but the reason you get into this is like, hey, this is what I want to do. So take it a step further and do only the cases that you want to do.
Mm-hmm. One of your passion projects, if not the passion project, Messersmith, mm-hmm. The Story of Vera Jo. How did that grab you?
I saw the documentary called The Night Sugar Babe. Mm-hmm. And after I saw that documentary, it's kind of difficult to speak about because I respect all creators. I just felt like there was another lane left open to tell her story in a different way. And I also felt the challenge. It was challenging because it was a trillion different names. And I'm like, a lot of people comments on the other documentaries that they couldn't remember all the people. So I'm like, now I have my directions to take this slower, make sure everybody's name is understood, and make sure you really see it from Vera Jo Messersmith's eyes. And just the things that they did to her. I mean, that's my most popular video, but I left a lot of stuff out on purpose because of how horrible they did, the things they did to her. I left it out. And I would tell you this, I haven't told anybody. You know, when she died, she was trying to save her daughter from that family. And her daughter was just a one-year-old baby. The foster parents who adopted her daughter after she died, they contacted me from watching my video, and they've sent me photos of her for like the last 3 years that she's grown up to be a beautiful girl, man. And it is so awesome. I mean, the last time I talked to them was like a little over a month ago. And so if she died to save her baby little girl, she didn't die for no reason. She is a healthy, smart, beautiful girl growing up in a world totally far apart. And that's the stuff that, like, that's the best that you can get out of doing these kind of documentaries.
That's one of your most popular videos for Stephanie, Madeline McCann, who was responsible. That vaulted you really to the YouTube true crime viral sphere. I don't know if I'm just making up that word right now, but that really kind of put you on the map.
It was the video that got me into the algorithm. And I remember because I'm still working full time when I was doing that case, and I was working at Verizon, and I was in the back room, you know, like just hiding and pretending I was getting phones or something, but I wasn't. I was researching just every spare minute, and I just became immersed in that case. And it's just so funny looking back on it now, because it was the one that got me up there and into the algorithm. But it was what, 2 years ago, almost over. And, you know, it's been my living room. I'm using this awful mic. You know, the sound is not good. The lighting, I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to record before people, you know, everyone got up in the house. And to look at it now, like, I have a recording studio and I have a great setup. And I think that, you know, my delivery is much better, but it just shows you that, you know, what the people care about at the end of the day is the content, like what you're talking about. They don't really care. I mean, some of them do, you know, obviously good video and good audio is important, but if you're delivering information that's important and interesting, they will watch it no matter what. And that's what happened. And that case has still bugged me, even though they, you know, Madeline McCann, they say it's solved now.
They did. Well, I talked to you about that. I would say this. I am one of the fans that love her video on that. And I never thought for 1 second about any sound quality. I was just glued into the story about how you gave the details.
Yeah, it's so long. And as somebody who lives in this audio space and is just now venturing out in a video to do promos on social media, mm-hmm. if somebody's got a great story to tell, so long as they are able to be understood, doesn't matter if it's some janky microphone you picked up at a Radio Shack liquidation sale or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it really just matters with the story.
And that's why I always tell people, they're like, "Oh, what should I get to start YouTube?" And I said, "Just put your phone up, pick your iPhone up, mm-hmm. sit down and record." You know, they've got great video on these iPhones now, great sound. You can do it. And then if it takes off and you like it, because it's a lot of work, and I don't think people realize that it is a lot of work, a lot of that you don't see on camera. You know, if you dedicate yourself to that and you want to continue it, then you can invest in the channel and in yourself. But start with your iPhone to see if it's even something you're going to want to do. And if you're great on camera and you know what you're talking about and you're starting a conversation, people will watch. They'll show up. You just have to do it.
I would tell people too, and I make it, I go out of my way to let people know, because I get all the compliments on how visually people like my visuals and how it looks. I don't have the most expensive stuff. And I show people how you can get the best out of stuff that doesn't take a lot of money, to encourage them to follow their dreams. And even if you can't afford anything, if you got an iPhone 8 or better and you got $14, buy Filmic Pro, the app on the iPhone, for $14.99, I think it is. Mm-hmm. You got yourself a professional camera. It unlocks everything about the iPhone. The focus, when something blurry or not, you can switch. It does everything. So you can start from there. And I will happily show people how you can get the looks that I have, and it's really inexpensive. I got her to get it, the Canon M50.
Yeah, I love it. Stephanie, that's a great camera.
I don't want to get too far away from the Madeline McCann. You mentioned that it's solved, and I think Both John and I looked at each other like,
yeah,
I'm sorry, way. What? What's that update?
I forget his name, but he's a German citizen, and they claim that it's him, and that he took her. And I mean, they don't have a body or anything like that, but I don't know how to say this without sounding accusatory, but it just felt like so much was left unsolved and not really clarified on the front of her parents. Like, there were so many things that happened with that case that that Madeline's parents contributed to that they just never really addressed, you know, like the fact that the cadaver dogs picked up the scent of decomposition in their apartment. Like the fact that they said all these adults went out to dinner and left all these little children in this apartment in a foreign country, in a city that they didn't know. And then nobody thought like, this isn't a good idea. You know, so much about it that just seems like it doesn't add up and it doesn't make sense. And for them to come out now and say, oh yeah, it was this guy you've never heard of. And we can't really tell you exactly why we think it's him, but you know, just trust us. It could very well be him. I forget his name, but I did an update video on it. It could be him, but just tell me why you think that and like show me the evidence, because until I have evidence, until you're showing me like his DNA, her DNA on him, something that's substantial that you could bring to a court of law, I'm still going to think that there's something we don't know.
Yeah. And this goes back to 2007. I mean, here we are nearly 14 years later and she's still not been found, right?
Mm-mm.
Wow.
Not found. Yeah.
What are you two working on together now?
So we're working on Arthur Shawcross.
Yeah,
Arthur Shawcross. He's from my area. I live in New York. So he, I think they call him the Genesee River Valley Killer. He was a serial killer. And so we thought he doesn't often get talked about when you talk about, you know, the infamous serial killers like Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy. But he has, I don't know if interesting is the right word, but he has a very interesting backstory. There's some, what would you call it? Like kind of back and forth on whether he was responsible for his actions or if it can be explained by.
There's going to be heavy debates. And I mean, I've never seen so many psychologists have a serial killer's back as to say that he may have not been, you know, I mean, everything from the chromosomes, he got XYY chromosomes and not going to full just from. So that's before birth. That's when you're being formed in the egg. They're already making excuses and all of his whole life. It's interesting. And I think I like challenging stuff like this because you go into it knowing that people are going to be divided. People are going to be strong one way saying, well, all this stuff, he had no choice. And people are going to be the other way saying, I don't care what happened to him. He killed innocent people. And, you know, I'm be honest with you, that's how I'm leaning. You know, I'm not going to lie.
How much of your work is done online, considering so much can be done online now? Information requests, public documents, depending on the state you're in. I mean, I remember working in Florida and it blew me away how open the sunshine laws are in Florida as compared to California and other states, where you could get the governor's text messages if you just request it and it'll be in your email box tomorrow. You know, it's crazy how some states have. So what goes into actually putting together these things? I know it takes months. What kind of travel is involved? How much of it do you just do online? How difficult has it been during the pandemic to get a lot of that work done?
So FOIA requests aren't as easy anywhere else besides Florida.
I know Florida, again, Florida just blew me away. How much sun shines on their government records?
Yeah, their sunshine law. I actually am completely on board with that as somebody who,
yes.
I mean, I think it's there for a reason, you know, especially if the case isn't active, if it's not cold anymore, if you knowing more about the case isn't going to affect an ongoing investigation, then we should have access as the public to everything. And that's why the Casey Anthony case was so easy to do, because everything's out there, because everything, once, you know, she was acquitted, which I don't agree with, by the way, but once she was acquitted, everything was available. So you can go back and you can see text messages and, you know, police reports and interviews. And it's just, for somebody like me, it's just, it's almost like pornography. Like everything's there and I can put this puzzle together and I don't have to put a puzzle together with only 60% of the pieces and speculate on everything else. Cause I do not like to speculate.
Yeah.
When it comes to these cases, I want to make sure that it's very evidence-based.
I'm sure it's out there. The idea of just a true crime Florida podcast or series. Because
it would be never ending because it's Florida. So there's all sorts of stuff happening there every day. But otherwise, you kind of just have to make do with what you have. Personally, resources that I like are Scribd, because sometimes you can find really good like police reports and affidavits and stuff on Scribd that you can't find on the internet. And I'm like, oh, yo, Scribd, where'd you come from? That's amazing. You know, you pop in newspapers.com is extremely, extremely helpful, because if you just Google it, you'll find these articles.
Yeah.
But a lot of them say the same thing, almost as if they copied and pasted from each other. So if you go into newspapers.com, you can actually get the articles that were coming out around the time that the crime was happening. So you'll get like these little insights that you didn't see from these other very more general articles. And you can just go through and, oh, the victim's father says this. And, oh, actually, she had a shovel in her hand, not a flashlight. And you're like, oh, well, all these articles online say she had a flashlight. So this is something I didn't know. I do reach out to the victims' families. The more that I can, you know, have their help, obviously they are the ones who were there. They
don't
know
always
this
work out the way you want.
No, they know these, they know the people that are involved. They can also tell you things that haven't been published by the media.
Yeah, because by the time, a lot of times that you are knocking, time has passed to where the last time they were approached by somebody in the media, things were too raw, too fresh, too much pain to go through. And by the time you talk with them, in many cases, they've had a lot of chance to reflect and really put into perspective what they've gone through.
And I can imagine if you lose somebody close to you, and obviously, like you said, it's fresh, but then some time goes by and you realize, you know, that your loved one's name isn't really being mentioned anymore. And you don't want them to be forgotten. You want to make sure the person who's covering the case is going to be respectful and treat them with kindness, but you don't want their name to be forgotten.
Right.
And I would never, you know, if it was my child, especially, like I would want people to talk about them, but there's the other side of that where some people do make true crime content and it's exploitative and it's sensationalized, and you know, you can always tell, and I wouldn't want to be a family member running into something like that.
Yeah.
But you know, you have to make it work and put it together. I do like using books.
What kind of house guest are you, John, that you pop
knocking
over there
over
and break stuff?
I know, right? I will add this on that. There have been cases like the Jaron Lockhart case that I've done, and I got cussed out. Like the family members, they didn't want to have any parts of it. And it was interesting because I was nodding my head yes as they were saying harsh words, because I agreed with them. But the reason I agreed with them was because of how she's been covered. You know, they cover her badly, call her a prostitute, all this stuff. They just didn't understand my heart. Like, I'm doing this to, I'm going to make the world care about your, you know, your loved one. I'm going to make them really, really, I'm going to make the world see Jaron differently. And so I still did it, even though the family didn't want me to. And when you go, if you go look at that video, the top comments are all from family members who were crying and very happy at what I did.
Yeah,
so
because
you know,
they're worried.
They're getting all this crazy hate and stuff. Right. I don't blame them.
We've already been victimized. We've already lost a loved one. We don't want to have to go through it again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a huge concern, especially if we go back to the comment section.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's...
The look of exacerbation on your face right now.
I just don't understand it. And I don't want to police anybody. And I really am a very big supporter of free speech. Like, I want you to be able to say whatever you want to say, even if I don't agree with you. But it does hurt. It hurts you. You know, you become the case I'm covering right now. Phoebe Hansjuk, a 24-year-old woman died in a trash chute in Melbourne, Australia. So she went down the trash chute and she died. And obviously there's going to be a lot of, you know, her family does not think that this was an accident or suicide. They think that somebody did this to her. And so that's what the family believes. But you start talking about Phoebe and you want to be honest about all the events leading up. So you say things like, you know, she did struggle with depression and she had a little bit of a problem with alcohol. And then people will immediately jump in the comments and say, oh, well, she, you know, she was messed up. You know, she did this. She must have done this to herself because she had depression. And it just the generalizations, the broad generalizations make me completely uncomfortable. I want to take each person as a case, literally this one person. And we shouldn't look at it and say, oh, well, girls who, you know, start using drugs or drinking alcohol at 14, they're just going to end up, you know, in a bad position. They did this to themselves. Like, we can't take that because it's so, so multi-layered and so differently faceted. This is a person who may have shared some traits with other people, but she also had these things that made her different. And, you know, we can't just, I don't like victim blaming, you know, because I do think that if, that's why I want people to feel like this is somebody that they love and care about, because right. You wouldn't do that to your own family member. If it was your own family member, you'd be making excuses, you know, out the ears for why they had gone this way or done this, and you would excuse it. So look at somebody with empathy and don't just write them off. Oh, you were a sex worker? Well, you deserved to die. Oh, you had an alcohol and drug problem? Well, your parents must not have watched you. And so this was going to happen anyways. That's very rough for me. Really rough.
What's the name of your videos on Casey Anthony?
Kaylee Anthony.
Kaylee Anthony. Kaylee
Anthony.
All right.
What do you think will get more views? Kaylee Anthony or Casey Anthony? Honestly, what do you think will get more views?
Casey.
All right.
Because people are Googling Casey. They're not Googling
exactly.
Kaylee.
But she named it Kaylee. She named her videos off of the victim because they are the most important people.
They are the most important people. But the only time I won't do that is if it's a serial killer.
Yeah.
Because you can't. But yeah, it's and Lacey Peterson too, you know, Lacey Peterson. And
yep. Ugh. And that goes against the views. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying integrity. You know, we have integrity when we cover these stories. It's not always right. about what's going to get you the fastest numbers, you know.
If we worried about views, we would just talk about Chris Watts 7 days a week.
I don't know how it is. I'm not sharing my screen right now on Zoom, but you're obviously looking at my notes because that's one of the things I wanted to talk about with you next was Chris Watts.
I pulled the screen down. I'm like, wait, can we see his notes?
You're like, wait a minute, can we see his notes? Yeah, so 2018, Chris Watts in Colorado. Why does that story, for example, have legs?
Unfortunately, in my opinion, it's because of the actual, you know, horrendous nature of it. And because when people started talking about Chris Watts on YouTube, they would see that they would get a lot of views. And then they would talk about another case and they wouldn't get as many views. So they were like, oh, well,
preach.
What's happening? No, I'm going to go with the thing. Let me just keep talking about Chris Watts.
This is giving me money. It's giving me subscribers.
And it's not even the content creator's fault completely, but it's also the people that continue to click on those videos and watch them and give the views, because at this point, and I mean, it's still happening today.
Yeah.
At this point, what is going to be said that hasn't already been said 5 million times? What new information are you expecting to garner from these videos, or what are you expecting to get out of these videos that you haven't already gotten? The guy confessed, he's in prison. Is he trying to get out? Is he trying to act like, you know, he didn't do it now? Yeah, but this is pretty typical. He's already confessed. Let him go away. Let him go away. Let him vanish from our memories. Let us have to forget that we ever had to walk the same earth as this man. So go away. But it brings in the views. And I can't for the life of me understand why it continues to bring in the views.
I think initially at the beginning, the difference between Shanann Watts and other victims is the amount of video she made on herself that other people at home can connect to her, which is innocent at first. And everything ends. Remember, I told you when I first started doing videos, Caitlyn video drop, I got to go to the next one. It ends and it was hard. A lot of these people who are new to true crime and a lot of them first started with the Chris Watts case, it was hard for them to let go. So he confessed. They didn't get their thing that they normally get, a trial. He confessed. So then what do we do? We don't want to go. We don't want to disperse. Oh, Nicole Kessinger probably has something to do with it, even though there's not a shred of evidence to show that she did anything at all when it comes to the murder.
Yeah.
So, and a YouTuber can exploit that and use that every single day, 7 days a week. You'd be surprised at how many views you can get if you mention the name of Nicole Kessinger and it's bringing them money.
Address, if you could, the disparity between the coverage of white victims, white families, and victims of color?
When it's being covered in the news or on YouTube?
Both.
Well, I mean, I think that in my opinion, it's the I don't know how to say this without trying to place blame, but it is initially mainstream media's fault. Because if me as being a YouTuber, I'm not out there investigating. So if you want me, and you know, I've had this, people will say, can you cover this person's case? Can you, it's not getting enough coverage. There's nothing there for me to pull from. If it wasn't given the coverage it deserved by the media at that time, you know, whether it be 1967 or 1995. And I ran into this with a case recently. Her name was Sandy. She was a Black woman. She was murdered in her car. A very interesting, mysterious case with lots of leads, but there's nothing out there about it. Sandy Long, nothing. You know, the detective who was on it, he did an interview with a YouTube channel. There's a couple articles online. I think True Crime Daily did a video on it. But when you want to get really those details and kind of see like what happened in the investigation and who were the suspects and nothing, not even really a lot about her. And I really like to start there. I like to get to know this person first before I talk about their death. I want to know what their life was like. Nothing really. And so that's where it a YouTuber can't really make nothing and make something from it. You know, we need somewhere to start. I wish I could be out there doing the investigation and be on the police force myself doing it. But unfortunately, I'm the person taking what I have and making a story out of it so that everybody can hear it. So that's obviously changing, which is great, because now you're seeing these cases of POC victims getting more coverage and we can know who they were in life. So now we have something to work with. But before 2020, that wasn't necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we don't want to cover a wide range of cases.
Right.
It's going to be a 10 minute video. And then I don't even think that's doing it justice if I'm going to tell you what you can find in a 5-second Google search.
Right.
Yeah. I strongly agree with Stephanie. And that's why I was looking up here, make sure I get the names right. If you go back to 2003, and I remember it vividly, Jessica Lynch and the Army mm-hmm. was captured. This is coming off of Saving Private Ryan. The white blonde girl was captured. She was on the front of every magazine article. They blew her up insanely. It was out of this world. And at the same time, Shoshana Johnson was captured, Black girl, and she took a back seat to that. And it was a very big problem in the world. Like, why are we covering one well above the other? Well, if you go now, one way, if you want to make money on YouTube and true crime, if you can cover the Orson and Orrin West boys, that'll get you coverage. That'll get you every views, everything you want. If you want to explore the case, those are Black two little boys, you know? So, and if you want to grab an audience, you can make a billion videos on Kanika Jenkins. We got the big trial coming up with the reopening of the Kendrick Johnson. So people of color can garner you a lot of views and stuff as well. So you can't look at that information and say it's not changing for the better. Things may not be perfectly where you want it to be, but it is changing. And how I got mad at people exploiting Chris Watts, I'm now getting mad at how people don't care and they're exploiting those the Orrin and Orson West boys case too.
Yeah.
So
and that's the when you talk about Chris Watts too, because every big case, right? Every big case you could look at. Casey Anthony, Chris Watts, what's his name? The freaking Scott Peterson, your favorite, Scott Peterson. Yeah. Every case that you look at, you could find a case like that where the victim was Black, but it's not out there.
For sure.
That's kind of what's insane. And I mean, it's not insane. It's just so glaring. It's obvious. You know, you can find Cupcake McKinney was a case that I did, I think, last year. She was a little girl who was kidnapped. But even when I was looking into it, and I don't know what it is, but I feel like, what is it? What do you think it is? Like, just what? The headline is going to be what? Less clickable?
Now, I mean, if you want me to go.
Yeah, I want you to go.
Money-wise, robotic. if you look, old establishment likes to look at history. History is white person will get you more views than black person. They obviously haven't caught up with the times.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So it's best. A lot of big companies do that. Stick to what you know instead of taking chances, because the CEO doesn't want to get fired. So they felt like, hey, Jessica, white blonde, she's going to get way more coverage than Shoshana, even though they both were captured by our enemy forces. But YouTube is showing us that, like, it may not be that way. You know, people who step out on YouTube and covering cases of color, if it's a big, exciting case, I think the reason the Orrin and Orson West case blew up is not because of that they're black. I think it blew up because they're missing babies. Mm-hmm. And it seemed absurd for any babies to be playing in the backyard in the daytime and just go missing.
It was it's because it reminds people of the Lori Vallow, Chad mm-hmm. Daybell case. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. These little kids just go missing. The foster parents or the adoptive parents, they don't know. And I admit it's also got that whole mysterious sort of like, is there a cover up here? Is there a conspiracy? Mm-hmm. It's got that aspect to it. And right. I like that aspect as much as anybody else. It gives you a lot to pursue and it gives you a lot to go over. However, I'm so uncomfortable with the way this case, the Orson and Orrin Welles case is being covered mm-hmm. because it feels like 90% of it is speculation. Yep. And if these parents are innocent, I can't imagine. Like they are going through the loss of these two little children. And I know people say, oh, they were not their blood. It doesn't matter. You're raising these little children. You love them. You want to care for them and protect them. And now they've lost these kids and now they're being dragged through the mud. And that does make me feel very uncomfortable. I just wish people would be a little bit more responsible. And some channels have been covering mm-hmm. it responsibly.
Yeah, not all are.
No.
Would you want to go into law enforcement, either of you? Has this wet your whistle enough that maybe you're like, you know what? I can maybe be a detective or help in some way, shape, or form.
I help the way I'm helping now, but we're older now, you know, yeah, like I'm 41. Like if I had a dream thing that I could do right now, it would have been more towards being a defense attorney or, you know, I would love to be the one to deliver the closing arguments on a case. I think I would be very, very good at that.
I love seeing your face light up when you say that, by the way. A
cop, if I could change.
Yeah.
I think that as far as police work, yeah, but I never would have seen myself as just and they are great. Like I appreciate the police officers that are out there every day doing the right thing, being, you know, good at their jobs. But for me, it wouldn't be, I don't want to be out there arresting people for, you know, smoking a joint. I don't want to be out there giving people tickets for driving their cars. Like to me that I feel bad. There's bigger fish to fry. There's people getting murdered. There's people getting sexually assaulted, kidnapped. I would see myself more FBI, CIA. Sort of thing, you know, definitely a CIA. Oh man, if I didn't have a family, I'd be out there. Like you wouldn't even see me. I'd be in Russia. I'd be all over the place.
Yeah. How we do our cases.
I'd have my little like beret on you, like my spy, like we're in the world as Carmen Sandiego. But I would have, and you know, maybe the FBI, like kind of a John Douglas, like a behavioral analyst, like kind of figuring out why do people, you know, I've always, even as a young kid, I saw Silence of the Lambs and Clarice was, she was interviewing Hannibal. And I said, I want to do that because I really want to know why did you do this? Like what's process went through your brain? What were you thinking? And I think that it helps to have that collective knowledge because we can apply it when other crazy people go out and murder a bunch of people or they eat them or they do some crazy thing, like dress up like a clown, you know, stuff like that. Why is this happening? What happened in your childhood? So that's very interesting to me. I considered, you know, going back to school and getting my criminal justice degree just to have the information though, you know, to have that technical behind the scenes law enforcement information so that when I'm doing the cases, I can speak about it in an educated manner, but not to actually get my degree and work in there, but it may be in my younger days without a family. Yeah.
Yeah.
Staying on the personal side of things, Stephanie, you're in the documentary on Netflix about the Cecil mm-hmm. Hotel and the Lamb disappearance and death. What was the response like after that? And were you ready for it?
The response for the most part was positive, you know, especially from people that had already been with me. people that didn't know me, it was not super positive, because the way that it was, you know, I don't know how to say this.
Edited?
Yeah. I mean, the way it was edited, it made it look like I was accusing this Pablo Vergara fellow of, but it wasn't like that. I had not even ever spoken about him on YouTube. I didn't even know he was like a part of the case. Everything went down with him on YouTube years before I was even on YouTube for the first time. And I only made one video about Elisa Lam, and he never said his name in it. But when I was being interviewed, they were like, oh, do you know about this Pablo Vergara thing? And I'm like, no. And they're like, oh, here's what's happening. And I was like, that's awful. That's awful. Nobody should be doing that to him. And then they were like, well, look at the camera and explain what happened. So it does seem like that to me. It kind of does seem like that to me in the Netflix show, where I'm just telling what happened.
Yeah.
You know, not saying that I was part of that, but a lot of people saw it and thought, oh, she's telling us what happened because she did it. And so there were death threats, and there were, you know, a lot of accusations and things like that. Just insane for a couple of weeks. And then Joe Berlinger, he got on the Netflix podcast. What's it called? Do you remember that? It's like an after show for the what is it called? I forget. Sure. It's called something in the Netflix podcast. And he was like, no, like that didn't happen. Like, the people who were involved in our show were not the ones who were doing that to Pablo. But at the same time, anytime you do have to make a retraction, you would know this as a journalist, what percentage of people are seeing the retraction compared to what percentage of people saw the initial story with the incorrect information in there. So,
and the initial story being on the Netflix documentary and the retraction being on a podcast.
I mean, even as it was just last month, at the beginning of last month, I saw Pablo Vergara posted on Facebook, like, oh, I hear people are giving this Stephanie girl a hard time. Please don't do to her what she did to me. And I was like,
I wrote Pablo, helping, not helping.
Pablo, come on, man. And I wrote him a message, and I'm like, I know you're trying to help, but like it's not the right narrative that we're supposed to be operating on right at this point. So, you know, it's to be expected. It was so cool though. It was so cool to be a part of that, to see myself on TV. You know, I was like calling my mom and my dad. I'm like, you got to watch Netflix. And my mom and my dad are now sitting through this whole thing. You know, these four episodes, they're not. They're like, just tell us when you're on. And I'm like, oh, forget it. Just forget it.
There's no telling you when I'm on. You need to
just
go.
And then if you don't care enough to watch it.
Isn't it interesting, though, how it's a different feeling? You see yourself on a small screen on phones, and you know, you see yourself all the time. You're a YouTuber. But when you're on TV and it's not just somebody casting their YouTube to the TV, or it's not just, you know, you go to the Amazon Fire into the YouTube app, it shouldn't be all that different, but it is.
It is. Yeah. And I think the part that really stuck out to me the most was the lack of control I have over the final project, because that's not typically what I'm used to. I do everything myself. I research myself. I record, I edit. Everything is done. So I have my hands in every, you know, part of the process. So when I pressed post, I know that like, this is exactly what I want to send out into the world. And you're really trusting your life and your livelihood and your image in the hands of other people to kind of portray you. And then you're also, it's a much broader audience. So obviously my audience, they know me, they know I'm empathetic. They know I'm sensitive. They know I never accuse people. And I almost get shit. Can I swear?
Yes, please. It's fine.
Oh,
yes.
I get shit for it sometimes.
How did we go an hour without any?
I always have to be careful, but yeah. I was like, can I swear? John was like, I don't know. But I get shit sometimes. They're like, you know, you're sitting on the fence. And I'm like, I'm sitting on the fence because there's not enough evidence for me to go one way or the other. And I know you want me to like be gung-ho one way. But for me, I'm not ready to make that leap. So I'm very cautious about making any accusations ever, or even the suggestion. I mean, my tagline is allegedly, because I say it so many times, because I'm not trying to like accuse anybody or send the mob after them. So my audience watches the Cecil, and they see me as they know I am. So they didn't get that impression that I was doing that. But obviously, people don't know you, and you're exposed to a much broader audience. People don't know you. They see you and they're like, well, screw this girl, man. She sucks. Stupid girl, stupid glasses and your stupid makeup. And, you know, like, I hope you die a painful death for what you did.
Yeah, I can't read that. I get mad.
So, you know, it's
yeah,
you're
you
opening
never
yourself
live in the
up.
Comments. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and that would be the case for any public personality. Like, not everyone's going to like you. And I don't expect everybody
but they,
to like
if they're going
to
dislike you for something you did, not for something you didn't do.
They can dislike me for whatever the hell
that's
they want to dislike me for. I don't care. They can dislike that. I hate her hair. She's stupid. Her mouth is dumb. Okay. Like, that's fine. That's your right. But you do not get to send me death threats. Okay. Like, I would never watch something and be like, oh God, I hate the cut of his jib. Well, I'm going to spend time and write him an email to tell him that, and then to wish death upon him. Like, it just doesn't make sense. The extremes, but you know, the takes all to make the world go around. All kinds make the world go around.
How can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram at John Crimes, JonChry. YMES Crimes, CHRYMES. And you can find me on YouTube at John Crimes, JonChrymes.
Yeah, I'm just Stephanie Harlow. I'm Stephanie Harlow on Instagram. I'm Stephanie Harlow on YouTube. I'm Stephanie Harlow on TikTok, I think. I'm Steph _ Harlow on Twitter. And you know, just that's it. Just type in Stephanie Harlow. My podcast is Crime Weekly. You can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I co-host it with Derek Levasseur, who's a retired police detective.
He's awesome.
He's cool. Yeah, also, yeah, he's a Big Brother winner. So you can find me anywhere. It's just type it in. It's Harlow with an E on the end, though. Sometimes people.
You mentioned TikTok. Is all your content there true crime and kind of a mirror or introduction to the YouTube, or are your kids
fun?
are your kids trying to get you into whatever's trending? It's like, okay, mom, we need to, you know, Corvette, or you know, or whatever, whatever's trending at the time.
Listen, it's pretty much it's my light place. You know, I go there. I'm usually light. I don't talk about true crime on TikTok because I talk about it on every other platform. So it's just where you'll find me being silly and being myself, and you'll see my kids. And you know, I don't do the TikTok dances though, man. I don't
can't.
Have time.
I
like
can't.
You know they're spending hours, maybe days, learning these dances. And who has the time? I see grown ass people doing these dances, and I'm like, where did your job go? Yes.
Yeah. I can't do it.
I don't know.
I can't do it.
It's so hard. And I just look so stupid. I remember when the Savage Love dance was a big thing. My kids were trying to teach me. And then my 9-year-old was like, all right, enough. Like, this is bad. This is bad. Yeah. Enough. Just please don't. You're good at a lot of things. This isn't your thing.
I got her to do the June bug challenge.
Yeah,
so.
That was
Hashtag June bug challenge. You know,
but thank also, you guys. Go ahead.
The first time, I feel nervous to say this. It's my first time ever doing it, but I'm going to plug my new podcast coming out called Alibi-ish with my friend Desi. So I'm nervous. It's my first foray into the podcast, but hopefully you like
Alibi-ish.
Yes.
When do you expect that to be released?
We probably should be dropping our first episode in a month. A
lot of moving parts with a lot of people in a lot of different places. I really appreciate the time today. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you so much.
All of Stephanie's and John's links are in the show notes. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Aaron Bender, on Facebook and TikTok at Aaron Bender Media. Invite you to like the Aaron Bender Podcast Facebook page and join me on YouTube. All those links are at AaronBender.com. Thank you so much for listening. If you have guest ideas or comments, email me, AaronBenderMedia@gmail.com. Be well.